This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society, brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Find out more about what we do at cbillpodcast.com. Jonah Goldberg addressed the Society on Friday, November 21, 2008, on the subject of his latest book, Liberal Fascism. Mr. Goldberg is editor-at-large of National Review Online, a contributing editor to National Review, and a nationally syndicated columnist.
If I start with a standing ovation, why go any further? I want to say thank you very much to the Jefferson Society. You've been wonderful hosts so far. We'll see how that continues. And it's delightful to be here. I feel somewhat embarrassed because the bio that was just read of me is a little outdated. Crossfire is no longer even on the air, so I'm really not an occasional guest host of it. The snappy thing is going to freak me out. It's like I'm in West Side Story, you know? When you're a jet, you're a jet. And I should point out that the most important thing in my bio wasn't there, which is that when the LA Times picked me up as a columnist, Barbara Streisand canceled her subscription to the newspaper in protest. And, I mean, talk about a standing ovation. And if I were in show business, I would just leave on that high note, because it just doesn't get better in my line of work than that. There's also, I suppose, since we're doing this sort of thing, there's been a grueling book tour, and probably the highlight of it was that Keith Olbermann named me the worst person in the world at least three times in this last year alone. Two more, and I'm an ace. I think he doesn't really appreciate that I'm such a pain in his ass, because that's the fastest route to his brain. Decorum! Decorum! So anyway, you get what you pay for. In broad brushstrokes, those of you who don't know, the central argument of my book in simple terms is simply this, that fascism always was a phenomenon of the left. Now, where on the left you want to put it, you can have great argument about that. I love those arguments. We can get more into details about that, but it was a phenomenon of the left. Now, this runs completely counter to pretty much everything most everybody has been taught about fascism. It's considered just essentially to be axiomatic that fascism is right wing. The terms are considered synonymous. And for 70 years, this has been the case, where fascism has basically been defined as a right-wing phenomenon. And this is largely because I would argue that liberals have had a monopoly on political virtue. They've argued for 70 years that the further you get away from me, or the further away you get away from the left, the more evil you become. The closer you get to the left, the more good you become. And this sort of moral spectrum has basically been the way we would define and continue to talk about politics even today. And so the word fascist has just become, in many ways, I mean, Orwell noticed this as early as 46, where he says fascist has come to mean anything not desirable. I would argue that today the best working definition of a fascist is simply a conservative who's winning an argument. Since 9/11, you've probably noticed there's been this enormous cottage industry of calling conservatives fascists, Republicans fascists, Bush Hitler, Cheney in the Nazi uniform, and all this sort of nonsense. Naomi Wolf, who some of you may know, is an influential feminist author, probably most famous for being a consultant to Al Gore in 2000. She was the one who told them that if you only wear more earth tones, people will stop confusing you for a robot. She's now written two books. Not one, two books, basically arguing that America today is literally, not figuratively, metaphorically, poetically, onomatopoetically, anything like that, literally that America today is indistinguishable, or at least prior to the election, the recent unpleasantness, as some of us call it, that prior to, you know, that George Bush's America is indistinguishable in any significant terms from 1930s Germany. Early 1930s Germany, to be fair. We'll get back to Naomi Wolf. Joe Connison did a very similar kind of thing. He wrote a book, or he typed a book, something about star-spangled something fascism, authoritarian peril in the age of Bush. He was sort of embarrassed because his whole argument rested on this thing about one-party rule and how Republicans ran everything, and then like 2 weeks later, the Democrats took over Congress, and he went quickly to the remainder shelves. But Christopher Hedges, a Pulitzer Prize-winning former New York Times reporter, had a book out titled simply American Fascists, in which the argument was deadly serious that basically Christian conservatives are fascists. And all of these books were received with respectful notices in all of the major intellectual left-wing press, liberal press, mainstream press, and the like, even though I would argue that all of their arguments are vastly more offensive, particularly Naomi Wolf's, than anything I say in mine. And yet you had people just going batty, getting their dresses over their heads about my book. We'll get to that. The basic argument behind this whole, you know, Bush is Hitler thing, this, what Janine Garofalo calls the 43rd Reich, it's pretty simple, which may be why it's so appealing to so many simpletons. It goes like this. Bush clamped down on civil liberties, Hitler clamped down on civil liberties. Bush launched a so-called war on terror, Hitler launched a so-called war on terror. Bush invaded countries, Hitler invaded countries. Hitler lied, Bush lied, Hitler was mean, Bush is mean. Auschwitz, Guantanamo, what's in the name? Now, I think the stupidity of all this should be self-evident, but if it's not, we'll get to that. But why is this stupidity so prevalent? And I think one answer that sort of needs to be addressed, particularly on college campuses, is simply this. There's a burning desire on the left to have bravery on the cheap, right? To speak truth to power. You know, these guys who drive around in cars with these sort of idiotic bumper stickers, I don't know, Bush is scary or whatever, you know? It's precisely because Bush is not scary that they can drive around with these bumper stickers, right? I don't think anyone in Saddam Hussein's Iraq in 2002 was driving around in a car with a bumper sticker that said that Uday and Kusay are really scary, right? No one pedals around on their 50-year-old bicycles in Pyongyang saying Kim Jong-il is a really bad man. It is precisely because we live in a society that is not totalitarian, that is not authoritarian, that is not dictatorial, where people's civil liberties are not being crushed, that these people can go around and bravely speak truth to power. Newsflash for people like Naomi Wolf. In the 1930s, people like Naomi Wolf did not go on multi-city book tours denouncing Adolf Hitler. Just didn't happen. But, and this wouldn't bother me. We live in a free country, free speech, all that kind of perfectly acceptable, that's delightful, you know, knock yourself out. But stop bragging about it. Stop trying to take credit for your incredible heroism as you speak truth to power when basically no one gives a rat's ass. Now, the second point that's worth pointing out, is sort of the bulk of my talk, is that this is nothing new. That this has been going on for a long time, long before 9/11. During the 2000 Florida recount, remember Jerry Nadler had this thing where he said that, you know, the Republican efforts had the whiff of fascism to them. Jesse Jackson, I always had this outrageous thing where he says that because these octogenarian Jews in Palm Beach, Florida, couldn't figure out the butterfly ballot, that victims of the Holocaust are being singled out again. Deal with it. When I first came to Washington, Newt Gingrich and the Contract with America was the big thing, right? And I was amazed. One of the reasons I started thinking about this book was because of this experience. I was amazed at how quickly the left went to ad Hitlerum arguments. Just immediately went straight to him. When Newt Gingrich invited the Congressional Black Caucus to a bipartisan meet-and-greet cocktail party, where they were just going to get together in the spirit of bipartisanship and reaching across the aisle and in national unity and whatnot. Major Owens replied, he's a congressman in the U.S. Congress, he replied, these are people who are practicing genocide. They're practicing genocide with a smile. They're worse than Hitler. We're going to have cocktail party genocide. It's always, whenever I read that, I always imagine that scene from Airplane where every time Lloyd Bridges is talking, like a spear flies against the wall or something blows up. Charlie Rangel said of the Contract with America, Hitler wasn't even talking about doing things like this, which is technically true. Hitler wasn't talking about zero-based budgeting or term-limiting committee chairs or anything like that. In the 1960s, everyone simply knew that all intelligent people knew that Barry Goldwater was a fascist and a Nazi. Daniel Shore, that guy who's now on NPR, but he used to be important and relevant, when he was the chief correspondent on the CBS Evening News, he reported, as a matter of fact, that Barry Goldwater's planned vacation in Europe after he secured the Republican nomination was really a clandestine effort to, quote, link up with neo-Nazi elements in Hitler's stomping ground so that they could coordinate the fall campaign. All of this was a lie. Goldwater wasn't going to Europe, he wasn't a Nazi, anything. But you could just say these things because you were allowed to say these things back then because everyone knew that you were that if you were a conservative, you were a Nazi. Ronald Reagan was not coincidentally was called a fascist from the moment he started picking on communists in Hollywood to his dying days. There's also my own personal experience. For years, long before I was working on this book, I would get called a Nazi all the time. Usually from people who put in an email and they think if it's in all caps, it must be true. But this was always sort of, remarkable. It was always really confusing to me. I grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, right? And even before I went to work on this book, a cursory survey of the relevant academic literature revealed that there weren't a lot of Nazi Goldbergs. But I would always hear people like my father or Irving Kristol or William F. Buckley, people I loved and admired, being called Nazis. And it profoundly confused me. I'm sorry, I smoked an enormous amount of pot before I got here. I'm really thirsty. But I would hear these conservatives, these people I looked up to and admired and believed like they believed, and I heard them being called Nazis all the time and fascists. And what was so weird about it, in a place like the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where being politically conservative made you feel like you were being oppressed. I mean, we were like Christians in ancient Rome. You go to Riverside Park, you draw a little C in the dirt, I'll meet you in the catacombs under Zabar's, we were supposed to be the Nazis, and it was always terribly confusing to me. And so here I'm going to start by saying why I think this is wrong, by doing something that my critics hate me for. The thing is beyond the pale illegitimate. I'm going to define my terms. Somehow this is something that's just not done in polite society, apparently, when you're on the winning side of an argument. What do we mean by right-wing in America? What do we mean by being a conservative in the Anglo-American tradition, which to date is still the relevant tradition that we're talking about, right? I would put forward that conservatism, that to be right-wing, involves having two pillars. There are two pillars of what involves being a right-wing. One is the classical liberal one, right? Adam Smith, John Locke, free markets, free trade, limited government, federalism, property rights. That entire cohort of issues, right? When someone is a radical libertarian in American politics, the left says they're right-wing, right? The other time they say they're right-wing is when they're describing the other pillar of conservatism, which is social conservatism, right? Family values, the Judeo-Christian tradition. You don't necessarily have to be religious, but you have to have respect for religion, respect for transcendence, respect for the tradition and culture that stems from these sorts of things. Now, if you put these two pillars together, you have conservatism in the Anglo-American tradition. Now, there are big arguments on the right about the trade-off between one and the other. Since the dawn of the American modern conservative movement, there have been these arguments about the trade-offs between freedom and virtue. At National Review, we championed an argument called fusionism, which argued that virtue not freely chosen isn't virtuous. And therefore, in a virtuous society, you needed freedom. And it balanced these two things. But there's an ongoing argument. But needless to say, if someone disagrees with me, I'm glad to hear it afterwards. But I would posit that I define right-wing in these terms, as a mixture of these two pillars. You can be all one or all the other, but usually it's a combination of both, means you're right wing. Now, the Nazis and the fascists despised these two pillars. They hated Manchester liberalism, they hated free market economics, And they hated traditionalism, traditional conservatism. They hated traditional religion and all of the rest. And yet, somehow, even though they hated both of these things, were told that the Nazis were, and the fascists were, in fact, right-wing. In fact, you hear this thing... It was good pot. You hear this thing all the time with, it's this circle theory, you know? You get this tweety, vital center, Arthur Schlesinger kind of liberal with elbow patches who make this argument about how, you know, I'm not an extremist. You know, besides, all political ideologies become indistinguishable at the extremes, you know? And then it'll draw a circle, and it'll show how the right wing and the left wing, they merge at the bottom, and they both become totalitarianism. And we get this from Clinton Rosser, we get this from Hannah Arendt, we get this from a lot of respectable, interesting people. And the problem with it is it's what de Tocqueville would call a clear but false idea. Nowhere else in life do we talk about something being so extreme one way it becomes the other thing. Something isn't so hot it's cold. Something isn't so tall it's short. Something isn't so fat it's thin. The only exception I'm aware of is that we do say that bulldog puppies are so ugly they're cute. But beyond that, nowhere else in life do we say that extremes meet, except in this wonderful world of political ideologies where nice liberals once again get to define themselves at the complete opposite end of all bad things. And that's simply not the way it works. The reality is, as Richard Pipes, the intellectual historian from Harvard, would say, is that fascism and Bolshevism were not opposites. They were both heresies of socialism. They both come out of the socialist tradition. They're both variations on socialism. Important differences between them. Even Leon Trotsky, right, who's the intellectual architect of much of Bolshevism, identified fascism as right-wing socialism. Now, from where I come from, if you're on the right side of the socialist spectrum, you're still a socialist. And the key difference between fascism and communism, according to theoreticians, was simply that fascism was national socialism and communism was international socialism. The way the things actually played out, all of them turned out to be national socialisms, but we can get that into that later. So anyway, these are my two pillars of conservatism. And so I used to have fun when I was on college campuses and some kid would call me, you know, usually it was the kind of kid with open-toed shoes and a closed mind. And, you know, I'd be on this campus and I would be advocating tax cuts, you know, fascists. And so I would love to ask him, I would say, you know, look, except for the murder, bigotry, genocide, and war, what is it exactly about Nazism you don't like? And they would look at me the same way my basset hound used to look at me when I tried to feed it a grape. With a total unblinking incomprehension. You know? So, taking advantage of this sort of pierced tongue-tied silence, I'd explain a few things. First of all, the Nazis were socialists. The Nazi ideologist Gregor Strasser actually explained this pretty well. He said, "We are socialists." He went on to say, "We are enemies, deadly enemies of today's capitalist economic system with its exploitation of the economically weak, its unfair wage system, its immoral way of judging the worth of human beings in terms of their wealth and their money." The first speech that attracts Adolf Hitler to the Nazi Party is titled, "How and by what means shall capitalism be destroyed?" The Nazi Party platform, co-written by Adolf Hitler in 1920 with Anton Drexler, demanded in part universal guaranteed jobs, the abolition of incomes unearned by work, which is basically a shot at sort of Wall Street finance type stuff, the nationalization of all large corporations and trusts, profit sharing in all major industries, expanded old age insurance, a government takeover of big department stores, think like Walmart, the prohibition of child labor, and countless other progressive reforms. Then I'll explain that the Nazis, all in the name of progress, sought to purge the authority of the church and the authority of tradition from society, and to replace them with the supremacy of the state, the dictates of political correctness, and a fundamentally pagan faith. All this Gaia worship and Da Vinci Code stuff that you've been hearing about the last few years, all of this traces itself directly back through Nazism in Germany. In Mein Kampf, Hitler denounces Christianity as a, quote, spiritual terror that had smashed the pagan altars of the much freer ancient world. Anticipating a lot of the arguments you hear from people like Gloria Steinem and other goddess feminists, Heinrich Himmler denounced the medieval witch hunts as a genocide by the Catholic Church. This is Himmler here. The witch hunting, quote, the witch hunting cost the German people hundreds of thousands of mothers and women cruelly tortured and executed by the church. When some Protestant bishops visited Adolf Hitler to register their complaints about Hitler's efforts to purge Germany of traditional Christianity, Hitler's rage got the better of him. Quote, Christianity will disappear from Germany just as it has done in Russia. The German race has existed without Christianity for thousands of years and will continue long after Christianity has disappeared. When the bishops objected that they supported Nazism's secular aims, just not its religious innovations, Hitler's anger gets the better of him, and he explodes, "You are traitors to the Volk, enemies of the fatherland, and destroyers of Germany." In 1935, mandatory prayer in school was abolished. In 1938, carols and nativity plays were banned entirely. By 1941, religious instruction for children 14 years and up was abolished altogether. Here's a perfectly typical Hitler Youth song. We are the happy Hitler Youth. We have no need for Christian virtue, for Adolf Hitler is our intercessor and our redeemer. No priest, no evil one can keep us from feeling like Hitler's children. No Christ do we follow, but Horst Wessel. Away with the incense and holy water pots. Singing we follow Hitler's banners. Only then are we worthy of our ancestors. I am no Christian and no Catholic. I go with the brown shirts through thick and thin. The church can be stolen from me for all I care. The swastika makes me happy here on earth. It's a really cheery ditty. The Nazis partly grew out of and co-opted the first green youth and health movements in the West. The proto-Nazi philosopher Ludwig Klages, a rabid anti-Semite, wrote one of the founding texts of modern environmentalism, Man on Earth, which reads a lot like Al Gore's Earth in the Balance. When the German Green Party decided to celebrate the founding of the party, in 1980 they re-released Ludwig Klages' book. The Nazi war on smoking would make Michael Bloomberg's heart leap. Nazis led the world in researching organic foods and alternative medicines. The concentration camp Dachau boasted the largest alternative and organic food medicine research lab in the world. According to the medical historian Robert Proctor, the Nazi campaign against tobacco and the whole grain bread operation were as fascist as the yellow stars in the death camps. Nazism rejected open scientific inquiry in favor of research dictated by relativistic and holistic, big buzzword back then, imperatives, and was tainted with a mysticism that exalted the natural order above reason. A lot of these buzzwords that I think they're still teaching on college campuses, like logocentrism and deconstructionism, were coined by Nazi theoreticians. Hitler and his advisors endlessly discussed the need to move the entire nation to vegetarianism as a response to the unhealthiness promoted by capitalism. Any week you turn on Bill Maher on HBO, you'll hear the exact same argument. Now, I can do the exact same thing with Benito Mussolini, but I'm not going to go that much in depth. But just for starters, Benito Mussolini, the name Benito isn't even Italian. It's Spanish. He's named after Benito Juarez, the radical Mexican revolutionary. Benito Mussolini's father was a member of the First Internationale, along with Marx and Engels. His dad used to read him Das Kapital as a bedtime story. Mussolini earns the name Il Duce, not as the head of the fascists, but as the leader of the Socialist Party in Italy. Now, there's another way I can demonstrate my point, right? If this doesn't work for you. My point that fascism belongs on the left side of the spectrum and that fascism and communism were not, in fact, opposites. One of them is what I would call a visitor from Mars test, right? I would just simply say, go around with my description of left-wing and right-wing. And for the record, my idea of left-wing is an omnicompetent government or the desire to create an all-inclusive state that redistributes wealth, that is secular, that believes in a progressive notion of history, it defines its rationale and that its job is to do good where it can, when it can, whenever it can, and all of the rest. A general sort of basic left-wing, right-wing critique of a modern left-wing welfare state. Anyway, so you ask a guy from the Mars, right? And you say, go around the 20th century and just look around, right? Walk around the 20th century and say, okay, this is what I mean by right-wing, this is what I mean by left-wing. What regimes and societies were left-wing and which ones are right-wing? No one has disputed, as far as I can tell, that by the way I define my terms, that fascism would belong on the left. Now, again, we're on the left, you can have a wonderful argument. And if you want to define your terms differently, I'm all in favor of it. But it seems to me my definitions are pretty reasonable. There's another way to do this if this doesn't work for you, if you don't necessarily trust the Martian test or if Dennis Kucinich is not available. You can go back and look and see what people had to say about fascism when fascism was new and fresh in the world. Now, here's the point I got to make very quickly. We tend to play the movie backwards. We tend to start with the Holocaust and then rewind the film and say anything that comes after the Holocaust when we're going in reverse is should be tainted with the Holocaust, right? But the reality is that fascism in the 1920s had nothing to do with the Holocaust. And just to give you a sense of how this idea that fascism and genocidal racism and bigotry are synonymous terms, as we've been taught how that's wrong, just so you know, Jews were overrepresented in the Italian Fascist Party from its founding until 1938, when Mussolini essentially becomes Hitler's bitch and has to do his bidding. But until then, Mussolini, and certainly before 1932, Mussolini was dedicated to keeping Jews in the party. Was very, you know, you used to say all the time how the founders of Italian nationalism, so many of them were Jewish. They were welcome to the party. They were also major members of the anti-fascist parties. But this idea that fascism and genocidal anti-Semitism or even anti-Semitism are synonymous is something we impose on the word fascism because of the Holocaust. But it wasn't the reality in the 1920s. Anyway, so one of the things I do in my book is I go, I knocked off my little fuzzy head thing here. I go back and I look at what progressives had to say about fascism in the 1920s. And lo and behold, they dug it. Herbert Croly, the founder of the New Republic, the author of The Promise of American Life, the George Washington of the progressive movement in the progressive era, had a full-on man crush on Mussolini. Defended Mussolini in the pages of the New Republic for 10 years, saying how comparing him to Lincoln, much like we're comparing someone else to Lincoln these days. Defended him against all critics, saying that what he was doing was this bold and exciting experiment that needed to be emulated here at home. Charles Beard, probably the most important economic historian of the 20th century, the guy for whom we are indebted to this whole idea that the founding fathers were just a bunch of rich white men trying to reward themselves and feather their own nests and all the rest. He too thought Benito Mussolini's Italy was a fascinating and exciting experiment that we needed to emulate. Ida Tarbell, the most important and famous muckraking journalist of the progressive era. The State Department didn't want to give, she's the woman who brings down Standard Oil. The State Department didn't want to give her a visa because they were afraid if she went to Italy, she would cause too much trouble. She got one anyway, she goes to Italy, just thinks that Mussolini's the cat's pajamas. Lincoln Steffens, the guy who, people used to remember this, had gone to the Soviet Union and come back and said, I've been over to the future and it works. The year before he goes to the Soviet Union, he'd actually been to fascist Italy and came back and said pretty much the exact same thing. He also said the stony stuff about how God had formed Italy out of Mussolini's rib and all this stuff. But the point remains. When Will Rogers is named the ambassador at large of the American press corps, he goes on a fact-finding tour throughout Europe. He gets off the, comes back into New York Harbor. He gets off the boat. The reporter from the New York Times says, you know, Mr. Rogers, you know, what did you think of Benito Mussolini? And Rogers says, that is some wop. I am really high on that bird. The song You're the Top, when they brought it over to the United States, they changed the lyrics to, from whatever they were to You're the Top, You're the Houdini, You're the Top, You're the Mussolini. Because Mussolini was just simply so popular in the United States in the 1920s. In 1932, H.G. Wells is invited to speak at Oxford to the young liberals. People today barely remember H.G. Wells basically as a science fiction writer, but in his time, he was arguably the most important intellectual in the English-speaking language. Hugely influential on the progressive movement, hugely influential on the social gospel movement. In the 1930s, when he would have these Oval Office visits with FDR, afterwards he would come out, the press would cover it like it was a papal visit. And then H.G. Wells would go on the White House lawn and you would say FDR represents the culmination of the world brain and other real moon batty stuff. But regardless, he was this incredibly influential guy, one of the most important members of the Fabian Socialists. And he's invited in 1932 to the Young Liberals, by the Young Liberals at Oxford, to give a speech about his own ideology and where he thinks the left, the progressive movement, the liberals, the socialists, where we all need to go. And he says, you know, I've been trying all my life to come up with a label that defines what I believe, that describes my philosophy, and I've never been able to do it. And he runs through all these weird ones, and he did have some weird, like the New Republic. I was really hoping that had something to do with the title of the magazine, but it doesn't. And he runs through all of them and he says, but I finally figured it out. I finally have an idea of what our ideology, what we need to do to have a phoenix-like rebirth of liberalism in the West. And he says, my ideology is liberal fascism. He also says that we need to embrace enlightened Nazism. And I suppose if I called my book that, I could have really made friends and influenced people. Now, the relevance of all of this is not necessarily what a lot of people think I'm saying. It's just simply to say, at least for the purposes of this conversation, that this idea that fascism and communism were these opposite phenomena would have struck people as nonsense in the 1920s. The fight between communism and fascism throughout the classical period of fascism and communism was a fight between Coke and Pepsi. These were people fighting for the same hearts and minds, the same constituencies. There is piles of social science about the red shirts switching to the brown shirts and the brown shirts switching to the red shirts. The Nazis and the communists voted together in the Reichstag. The communists used to have an expression, first brown, then red. And they were unified in their opposition to the bourgeois, to the aristocracy, to all these sorts of people. Lincoln Steffens himself would refer to the Russian-Italian method, because he considered what they were doing in Russia and what they were doing in Italy to be kindred and similar phenomenon, and that we needed to emulate this approach in the United States. Now, why did the progressives like fascism so much? Well, there are a lot of reasons, but I'm only going to get into two. One is the concept of William James's moral equivalence of war, right? It's a phrase we've heard a million times. Moral equivalent of war, how you make this the moral equivalent of war, that the moral equivalent of war. It comes from an essay by William James where he basically argues that war brings out the best in people. It inspires people, inspires youth, and inspires them to drop their petty personal ambitions and agendas and instead rally around large causes, causes larger than themselves, as we like to hear these days. Drives me crazy. And rally around the state, rally around large national causes. And the whole point of the essay is we need to come up with something that's the moral equivalent of war, something that causes people to drop their individuality, drop their petty personal pursuits, and instead rally around the government and march in lockstep with what the politicians and the government wants them to do. This became a philosophical obsession with progressives, the moral equivalents of war. You read the early progressive economists, they're constantly talking about how we need industrial armies where we draft people straight out of school into the workforce where they work in a factory for 30 years and then, you know, we give them a nice little pension and send them on their way. It is not a coincidence in the slightest that Benito Mussolini cited William James as one of the three most important philosophers in his life. The second point is that they saw in fascism and in Bolshevism proof that they had been right. They'd been right on the right track during World War I here in the United States. Now, this is where I get to have a little fun. It's not as much fun as when I went to the University of Wisconsin-Madison and just went through building name after building name, racist, eugenicist, racist, eugenicist. But still, Woodrow Wilson was a member for you guys. And I thought it might be a little fun to dilate for at least a moment on why I think Woodrow Wilson was, if not the first fascist dictator in Western civilization, then at least the first would-be fascist dictator in Western civilization. What's that phrase? What has two thumbs and hates Woodrow Wilson? This guy. Okay, so first I ask you to if it's all right, I'm going to take my coat off because I'm sweating like a fat man in an all-you-can-eat pasta bar. First of all, when we say fascist dictator, right, again, I'll just ask you to do the duck test thing. Forget ideology, forget preconceived notions, forget what all your civics teachers taught you about the glories of the League of Nations and all that nonsense. And instead, just conjure in your mind what you think a fascist dictator does or looks like. Well, don't do looks like, because then you can imagine a guy with a mustache and it ruins it. But what he does, okay? Well, the first thing I think of is goons, right? Thugs. Brown shirts, black shirts, guys who skirt the line between criminality and political enforcement, ideological enforcement, right? Okay. Well, Woodrow Wilson creates, under his Justice Department, the American Protective League, which at its height had 250,000 members, many of whom were had badges saying Secret Service, but they were secret agents that did not have to disclose their identity when they were spying on their neighbors, their employers, and everybody else. The American Protective League conducted mass arrests, invaded people's homes, interrogated people, beat people up in public, were in every way that we would think of in American culture, thugs. And they weren't, you know, I mean, they're not quite Acorn. But, you know, give Acorn some time. What else we would think about a fascist dictatorship? Okay, censorship. Under Lewis' administration, they closed down scores of newspapers and magazines. They threatened to close down hundreds of others. Sent a huge chilling effect throughout the society that anybody who dared print any criticism of the government, criticism of Wilson, was going to be shut down. Thought crimes. People were arrested for expressing contrary positions on politics in their own homes. One guy who said that Lenin was one of the brainiest people he ever knew or ever heard of, at a dinner table, was turned in by his son and sent to jail. A guy who made a film, a documentary about the British, about the American Revolution, in which he cast the British in a bad light, which I would think you're supposed to do as a good American making a film about the American Revolution, got 10 years in jail. A guy who refused to stand up for the Star-Spangled Banner at a baseball game was beaten to death by the crowd. A guy who refused to sing along at a Liberty Fund drive was shot in the back 3 times by a sailor. The judge refused to even hear the case. These sorts of things were commonplace throughout the United States under Woodrow Wilson. Another thing, you know, if you listen to some of the dimmer bulbs of the sort of culture, you know, like Bill Maher or Robert F. Kennedy Jr., you'll hear constantly about how fascism, all that fascism is the merger of big business and government. You know, when government and business are in bed together, when government is run by business or business runs government or blah, 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 whatever it is, then we have fascism. Well, under Woodrow Wilson's war socialism, we had the War Industries Board, in which the heads of American industry joined the government. They're called dollar-a-year men, and they basically rewrote the codes and laws of the society to reward big business. And we're still suffering from a lot of this stuff today. You have the Living Constitution, something that we definitely have with us today. You know, the Living Constitution, for those of you who don't know, is this very sophisticated legal doctrine which says the Constitution is like Felix the Cat's magic bag. And as long as a liberal reaches in deep enough and long enough and looks around hard enough, they can find anything in there that they like. It is thanks to Woodrow Wilson that we have the Living Constitution. Woodrow Wilson is the first president of the United States to openly disparage the U.S. Constitution and the Bill of Rights as no longer relevant, as needing to be thrown away and replaced with a new, living, organic constitution that basically empowers him as the, you know, leader of the Volksgemeinschaft and all this nonsense. You have the income tax. Well, I don't know if it's fascist. I just don't like it. None of you guys are even paying income taxes. Now, again, the point here is that the progressives supported the war. Yes, they liked its foreign policy aims, and they paid a lot of lip service to it. But what they really liked about the war was this moral equivalent to war thing, getting people to drop their individuality, drop their individual pursuits, drop their associations, disband the Burkean little platoons, and rally around the state. It's what John Dewey called, when he was arguing in favor of the war, the, quote, social benefits of war. He explicitly argued along these lines. He said, according to Dewey, Americans would have to, quote, give up much of our economic freedom. We shall have to lay by our good-natured individualism and march in step. This is the most important liberal philosopher of the 20th century, by the way. If the war went well, it would, quote, constrain the individualistic tradition and convince Americans of the, quote, supremacy of public need over private possessions. Walter Lippmann, arguably the most important liberal pundit of the 20th century, said the war would bring about a transvaluation of values as radical as anything in the history of intellect. Our faith in individual liberty and free markets would have to be rethought, quote, as fearlessly as religious dogmas were in the 19th century. Another progressive put it more succinctly, laissez-faire is dead, long live social control. To prove this point that this was a long-standing ambition and not just a rationalization of the war, you had progressives arguing as early as 1902 with Jane Addams, who said that we must, quote, we must demand that the individual shall be willing to lose his sense of personal achievement and shall be content to realize his activity only in connection to the activity of the many. Walter Rauschenbusch, the father of the social gospel movement, and I believe the grandfather of Richard Rorty, said in 1896, new forms of association must be created Our disorganized life, competitive life, must pass into the organic cooperative life. Elsewhere, Rauschenbusch put it more simply, individualism means tyranny. Now, this is my libertarian friend over here. The progressives were fascistic in all sorts of other fun and exciting ways. Woodrow Wilson was the most racist president of the 20th century, indisputably. He was a eugenicist. All of the major progressives were eugenicists and racist to one extent or another, or at least they had no problem hanging out with racists and eugenicists. Almost all of the opposition to eugenics came from what we would call the right, from people like G.K. Chesterton and the conservatives on the Supreme Court. All the progressives voted for sterilizations and all these sorts of things. They were jingoists and imperialists and warmongers and all that kind of stuff. But it's interesting, even arguments about things that you wouldn't think wouldn't have anything to do with racism, like the minimum wage, were explicitly fought for, particularly by the University of Wisconsin progressives, on racial grounds. E.A. Ross was one of the most important social public intellectuals of the progressive era, argued in favor of the minimum wage by arguing, he said, the coolie, the Chinese laborer, right, the coolie cannot outdo the American, but he can underlive him. The argument being that if you forced employers to pay a white man's wage, no employer would hire anything less than a white man. And it would have this positive eugenic effect by weeding out all these undesirable races from the society. But we don't have to get into all of that stuff. I think the relevance, particularly on college campuses, particularly at this moment in politics for all of this, is a simple one, or at least I'll do a less controversial one. Progressive has just simply come to mean good, right? I mean, progressive, ooh, it's a progressive coffee shop. They must have good coffee. You know, it's progressive music. You got to listen to the words. In the same way that fascist just means bad or evil, right? And again, this is something that Orwell noticed a long time ago, is that we've just come to use fascist to mean bad, to shut up people. When Al Gore compares people who disagree with him on global warming and compares them to Holocaust deniers, he's not doing that to open a conversation, right? When he says his critics are digital brown shirts, he's not doing that to spark a lively debate. He's doing that to shut up people, to anathematize them, as the church might say, to say you don't have to listen to these people, as those fierce social ostracizers, the Amish would say, to make you shunt. And I understand why fascism is an evil word. I do. Again, I went to Rodef Scholem Day School. I grew up on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. I would not want to do anything that belittled or minimized the significance of the Holocaust. I understand why it is the signature moral evil of the 20th century. Fine. Stipulated. Gladly. But it's worth pointing out that more people were rounded up and slaughtered on an industrial scale in the name of socialism than in the name of fascism by orders of magnitude. That's not even counting the fact that the National Socialists were socialists. Right? Stalin killed at minimum 20 million people. Mao killed at minimum, well, not a minimum, he killed, the best estimate is 65 million people. Pol Pot, Kim Jong-il, Fidel Castro, these guys glorified in slaughtering their own people and rounding up and murdering people. And yet, if I call you a socialist, I'm not saying you're evil. Right? In our culture, if I call you a socialist, you know, maybe I'm saying that you're confused about economics or you're Belgian, you know. Damn Belgians. And yet if I call you fascist, I'm immediately saying that you're an evil person. And one of the things I'm just simply trying to do with this book is simply say fascism isn't necessarily what you think it means. We'll come back to that. But I think all of this should be relevant for another reason, okay? It shows you how much progressives, or the left, have captured the language, that we just take it as a given that progressive means good, right? And that we don't question the intellectual underpinnings of the left. For example, Obama, when he was at the University of Wisconsin, he has this big rally after he wins the Potomac primary, you know, Maryland, Virginia, D.C., and he has this big rally, and he says, what better place than here, at the University of Wisconsin, where the progressive movement was born, to reaffirm the ideals of our campaign? Let's give him the benefit of the doubt and assume he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about. because the progressives at the University of Wisconsin certainly wouldn't have wanted his father to be allowed to immigrate to this country. They certainly wouldn't have allowed his parents to have a child. And they certainly would be terrified at the idea that some guy named Barack Obama could be president of the United States. Hillary Clinton, at the CNN YouTube debate last summer, it's a good question. She says, all those videos look like hostage videos, but this guy, he asks, what is a liberal and are you one? And Hillary Clinton gives a classic Clintonian answer, by which I mean she tries to take credit for a position she doesn't in fact hold. And she says, that's a great question. Well, liberalism used to mean sticking up for the freedom of the individual and fighting big power and the ability to do your own thing or whatever. It was ham-fisted, but it was fine. And then she says, but now it's come to mean big government. So I don't call myself a liberal anymore. I call myself a modern progressive, which has deep roots in the American tradition. Now imagine, I used to be a media critic. Imagine, just for the giggles, that Mike Huckabee is in a CNN YouTube debate, and he's asked, what is a conservative and are you one? And Huckabee says, well, it used to mean this, but now it means that, so I don't call myself a conservative anymore. I call myself a modern Confederate, which has deep meaning in the American tradition. Something tells me that the New York Times will get its panties in a bunch about this, right? Something tells me that my friends at the New Republic would get their dresses over their heads saying, oh my God, don't they understand the historical connotations and the meaning of the Confederate? And it would all be completely fair. But when you want to call yourself a progressive, it just means you're the good guy. That's all you need to hear. And be, oh, that's fine. No one ever asked them, which progressives? Because there were other people who called themselves progressives. There were the useful idiots who made apologies for Stalin's, crimes in the 1930s who called themselves progressives. Are they those progressives? Or are they the eugenic racist progressives? I mean, just clarify for a minute, Instead, you don't have to, because if you're on the left, you just simply assume that your heart's in the right place and you're the good guy fighting for truth and justice, in world history. A second point that needs to be made. I'm just dying up here. Thank you. A second point that needs to be made is that the progressives or liberals, if you want to call them that, have never abandoned the moral equivalent of war argument. It endures to this day. You're a great American. Thank you. Guess who's sleeping on the couch? They've never abandoned this moral equivalent of war argument, right? The New Deal was explicitly sold as a moral equivalent of war. FDR campaigned promising to restore war socialism in World War I. Remember, FDR himself was a Wilson retread. He was the Secretary of Navy, approved all of that terrible stuff I told you about before. And when he came in, he promised to fight the Great Depression with the same means and tactics that we fought World War I. In fact, one of the first people he appoints, right, to run the NRA, the signature program of the New Deal, right, not the National Rifle Association, you whippersnappers, the National Recovery Administration, he appoints Hugh Johnson, the guy who oversees the draft during World War I, General Iron Pants Johnson, Man of the Year on Time Magazine, 1933. I guess 1934, because I assume FDR was 33. And so what does Johnson do? Well, he goes into his White House office, he's unpacking his things. One of the first things he does is he hangs up his portrait of Benito Mussolini on the wall and starts handing out fascist propaganda to other members of FDR's cabinet. In fact, during the Democratic Convention, Hugh Johnson distributed a memo saying that what they needed to do was banish the Congress and the Supreme Court to an island for 90 days so we could really get some good work done. And there's a certain logic there. In 1960s, Kennedy's New Frontier was a moral equivalent of war argument. NASA was explicitly a moral equivalent of war argument having to do with the Cold War. The war on poverty, needless to say, was a moral equivalent of war argument. Jimmy Carter, when he wore that adorable Angora sweater in the White House and said that we have to, that keeping our thermostats low is the moral equivalent of fighting Hitler now, used the exact language saying it was a moral equivalent of war. Today, the best example of this moral equivalent of war nonsense is global warming. Right? Whether you believe in global warming or not, let's stipulate global warming is happening. The arguments that they're using about global warming are moral equivalent of war arguments. Time magazine outrageously photoshops its cover replacing the Marines raising a flag at Iwo Jima with Marines raising a tree and basically argues that green is the new red, white, and blue, their words, and that we now have to make fighting global warming the equivalent of what the greatest generation did. Pretty clear moral equivalent of war argument. New book came out this year, The Climate Change Challenge and the Failure of Democracy, in which the authors argue explicitly that democracy no longer works, that liberal capitalism no longer works, and that we need to have this new benighted rule of technocratic experts to govern society because we're no longer up to snuff to deal with the challenges at us. This is exactly the argument that was made for fascism in the 1920s and 1930s. Now everything is a new deal. The latest Time magazine has Barack Obama as FDR with a cigarette in his mouth riding around the convertible, and it says the new deal. It's written by my friend Peter Beinart. This new deal thing is a constant in American history since the 1930s. Every Democratic president in one way or the other has argued or aspired to have a new deal. After 9/11, you had Chuck Schumer arguing we needed a new deal. After Katrina, you had Chuck Schumer. Actually, I think Chuck Schumer just has like a macro on his computer. He has F10, and he says, it's time for a new deal. You know, I stubbed my toe. Time for a new deal. You have this obsession with authoritarian capitalism these days, where you have people like Tom Friedman who look at China, and they say, gosh, you know, why can't we be more like them? They banned plastic bags. You know, Tom Friedman actually has a chapter in his book called China for a Day. Why can't we be China for a day? Wouldn't that be just wonderful? Now, what if I had written a chapter saying, let's be Nazis for a day? And the argument is simple. Democracy doesn't work. And what we really need is this benighted technocratic rulers who can just impose a regime, get carbon pricing right, you know, because that's what republics are all about, is getting carbon pricing right. And everything will be wonderful. And it's this amazing thing, this envy of authoritarian capitalism. Look, authoritarianism has immiserated people for millennia, right? Authoritarianism is the standard form of government in human history. The guy with the biggest club beating up on anybody who gets out of line, that's authoritarianism. You know, people say, why is there poverty? It's an idiotic question. Poverty is the factory preset of the human condition. We are born ignorant and penniless as individuals and as a species. The question is, why is there wealth? And it's because of markets, free markets, capitalism, whatever you want to call it. We shouldn't use the word capitalism because it's a Marxist term. And yet you have these jabbering bandersnatches, right, who look at places like China, right? Now, China switches to markets as a last resort. Now, when I say a last resort, I mean a last resort. I mean, they kill 65 million of their own people. And then when that doesn't work, they're like, shit. Let's try markets. And boom, hundreds of millions of people are lifted out of poverty, right? And diseases are wiped out. Kids are educated. Literacy prevails. People go into school. You know, schools blossom. Businesses blossom. Millionaires come up all over the place. Everyone's got rising crust frozen pizza. It's a great time to be alive. And people like Tom Friedman watching this, they go, wow, it must have been the authoritarianism. It is a bizarre reaction. So anyway, I want to leave you, and I know I'm going on too long, I want to leave you with one basic thought. It has been ever thus. A big animating vision of my book is that basically the world is divided into two political visions, the Rousseauian vision and the Lockean vision. I have a lot of friends who say I'm being unfair to Rousseau and Locke, whatever. They're symbols. I'm not going to get into the second treatise on human, you know, all that kind of stuff, or Candide. The Rousseauian vision is the general will is all important, right? That our rights come from the group, that we're meaningless without the group, that the collective is essentially a spiritual entity, a tribe, whatever you want to call it, and all our meaning derives therefrom. This was the animating spirit of fascism, everything within the state, nothing outside of the state. There's the animating spirit of Dewey's liberalism, that all of our rights come from the group, and they are all conditional based on what the group wants you to have. The Lockean vision is that we are captains of ourselves, as Locke said, that our rights come from God, not from government, that the individual is sovereign, that our relationship with government is a social compact, it's purely transactional. The government gets to do certain things because it's more efficient to do these things, but then everything else we reserve to ourselves. Now, I think these two visions do a pretty good job of explaining the differences between political ideologies and whatnot, and I would defend them on those grounds. But it's also important to keep in mind that the human heart is divided between the Rousseauian and Lockean vision. You know, my favorite definition of conservatism is the idea that human nature has no history, right? We are all built from the crooked timber of humanity. We are all imperfect creatures, and we all want to belong to a group. We all want to feel that sense of commitment and belonging that we get from being part of a tribe or a race or a nation or any of these sorts of things. And to a certain extent, these things are healthy, human, natural desires. You know, we all want at some point or another to feel like we belong. We also want to feel like individuals. We also want to be our own people, to be respected on our own accomplishments and whatnot. And these two visions run through the human heart. We're all a little Rousseauian and we're all a little Lockean. But I would put to you that the left makes the mistake of the category error. Conservatives sometimes make this mistake. Libertarians never make this mistake. And it's simply this. The government cannot love you. It can't be your mommy or your daddy or your church or your synagogue or your tribe. It cannot give you meaning. It cannot be your village. It can't be your family. And what you get is a lot of people, they have this wonderful feeling, or they imagine they would have if they belonged to a good family or a good tribe. And they want to get out of government what they feel like they're either lacking or that they once had as a child or whatnot. You know, if only the government could love me. It's that the category error is that sense that, you know, the kind of person who says, and if we all work our hardest, we can make this the best yearbook ever. And they take that feeling and they apply it to government. And they think they can get it from government. And you can't get it from government because government cannot love you. But this is going to be an eternal fight. Because it's written into the human heart. It is in our DNA. It is written into our software that we're going to be having these fights. And conservatives, rightly understood, we may not always be called conservatives, but those who believe in this Lockean vision will always be outnumbered by the people who want to make this the best yearbook ever, right? We will always be on the minority side of this fight. Because generally speaking, most people, they want to have their cake and eat it too, and they don't care about these fine doctrinal distinctions. And so this is an eternal battle, and it's a good fight. You know, people, I go speak to conservative groups all the time, and, you know, I get these stodgy old guys who get up, you know, their martini glasses flopping around, and they'll say, you know, how are you going to stop the left from doing this? Or how are we going to fix this problem? And I tell them, we're not. You know, one of my favorite stories is about the physicist who's speaking to a giant lecture hall about the heliocentric nature of the solar system or something. And he's going on and on, and all of a sudden this little old man interrupts him. He says, excuse me, I'm sorry, but I think you've got it completely wrong. In fact, the planet sits on top of a giant turtle. And the physicist sort of rolls his eyes, but he thinks it's kind of funny. The audience is laughing or snapping. And so he decides to humor him. And he says, okay, well, you know, what is that turtle on? And the old man says, another turtle. And now the old man's getting annoyed. You can see where this is going. And so he says, you know, all right, and what is that turtle? And the old man cuts him off. And he says, let me stop you right there and help you out. It's turtles all the way down. This Rousseauian Lockean thing is turtles all the way down. We're never going to get past it. We're going to have some victories. We're going to have some losses. Sometimes one side is going to be right, sometimes the other guy is going to be right, and it's a good and noble fight to have. And so for the conservatives in the audience, I would simply say, enjoy it. Be happy warriors. Don't look for the silver bullet, because the silver bullet is a utopian dream. There is no such thing as a silver bullet. And, you know, if men were angels, we wouldn't have these arguments, but men are not angels. So instead, enjoy the fight. It's a good fight. It's a happy fight. It is a fight worth having. And to my leftist friends or liberal friends in the audience, I would just simply say this. Keep in mind the possibility that fascism means more than just bad, right? In the same way that something can be bad and constitutional, or good and unconstitutional, something can be fascist and good. In the sense that it takes no courage to point at things you don't like and you cry fascist. It takes real intellectual courage to look at things you do like, things that you think might be signs of progress, things that you think might relieve man's estate and make this a better world, and say, where will these things go? How far is the road to hell paved with my good intentions? And question yourself about these sorts of things. That is a healthy thing to do. And in the meantime, whether on one side or the other side, enjoy it. It's a good fight to have. And you're going to be having it for the rest of your lives, particularly if you're as idiotic as I was in pursuing the kind of career I did. So have a great time, and I'm delighted to take your questions. Do I go there now? I'll go here. Yes, sir. Well, they had a positive impact on my book sales, so they can't be all bad. Yeah, I do. I mean, I think it's fascinating. They have these surveys where they ask, you know, college students or 18 to 24-year-olds or whatever, where they get their news, and huge numbers. I mean, not necessarily super majorities or anything, but really, social science-wise, statistically significant numbers of these people, these younger Americans, get the bulk of their news from The Daily Show and Colbert. And that's crazy talk. I don't even understand how you guys get half of the jokes if you're not watching the rest of the news. It is idiotic to get your news from TV. TV is an entertainment medium. And you know, the idea that somehow you're getting your news, you know, from O'Reilly or Olbermann is terrifying enough, and they are vastly more informative than Jon Stewart is. And it is such a sort of cowardly, weaselly sort of humor. Not necessarily for Stewart. I don't mind him doing it. That's good. You know, that's entertainment. But for the college kids who sit there laughing and think it's so brilliant and insightful and all this kind of crap, it is so cheap, you know, to think that you're a sophisticated person because you're laughing at these jokes, even though you haven't read any of the articles that the guy's talking about, or really don't know anything about the people or the ideas behind them. It's childish. But that's part of a larger problem than just these silly shows. I mean, I think cable television news and all that stuff is a sign of social decay. But, you know, you're not going to fix that either. Yes, sir. Kathleen Parker, a friend of mine, at least as far as I'm still concerned. She's been making a lot of headway. She's a columnist. We run her syndicated column on NRO. At least we still do, I think. And she's just been having a grand old time bebopping and scatting all over Sarah Palin and over the social conservatives, Christian conservatives and whatnot in the GOP. And I recently just got sick of it, you know, because she's constantly bragging about how much hate mail she got, you know. And, I mean, if you want to see hate mail, I mean, it's sort of like Marcellus Watson's, you know, briefcase in Pulp Fiction. Just peek into the glow of my email box sometime, you know. I mean, or it's like when the Nazi looks in the Ark of the Covenant and his face just, you know, melts. You know, so I don't have a lot of tolerance for people who want to do this sort of, you know, posing about how brave they are because they got a bunch of ones and zeros in their email box saying that they don't like them. You know, welcome to my world. And so she's bragging about all of this stuff. She's part of this big, long thing with Christopher Buckley. It's sort of a gossipy inside right-wing thing. I don't want to get into all the details. But her signature point, which she had in this recent column, which is what elicited my wrath, was... She argues that the GOP needs to jettison social conservatives. Now, funny, this gets back to this two pillars thing I was talking about at the beginning. There is this myth out there that there are these huge numbers of, you know, knuckle-jagging, troglodytic, Bible-thumping, Cotton Mather right-wingers, right? And then there's this other bunch of Republicans who are libertarians, who believe in limited government, right? And the reality is, if you actually look at the polling data, if you actually go out to real America and look at this for even 2 seconds, or look at Congress, you'll discover that most pro-lifers are also free market conservatives who believe in limited government, George Bush notwithstanding. And routinely, the people who are the, you know, love to describe, preen and talk about how they're fiscally conservative but socially liberal. Well, if you define fiscally conservative as actual low taxes, small government, you know, shutting down the government kind of thing, then they're just liars. Because the reality, and statistically speaking, because the reality is that most of these socially liberal people are actually fiscally liberal too. Maybe not as fiscally liberal as Democrats, but getting there. And we can argue about this later, Ron. So I think this idea that somehow the Republican Party can afford to just chuck over the side a spare 30 or 40 million voters, right, and just go with the libertarians and the hawks to win elections is, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, it's too stupid. To really believe that, you have to be too stupid to be a spell checker at an M&M factory. I mean, it's idiotic. And Bill Buckley talked about this, you know, in great detail in the 70s, and we were talking about the influx of right-wing Democrats who moved into the Republican fold, you know, after the Civil Rights Act and all that. His argument was not to take these people and let them keep their attitudes intact, but to convert them to conservatism. And these people who want to, you know, like my friend David Frum or David Brooks, who want to sort of mock and pillory Sarah Palin, you know, as problematic as Sarah Palin is, and there are perfectly good arguments there, rather than try to win over Sarah Palin supporters or win over Sarah Palin's or their ideas is just sort of silly. You know, I mean, what does Stalin say about the Pope? You know, how many divisions does the Pope have? You know, how many divisions does David Brooks have? You know, I mean, Sarah Palin has got a lot of supporters, a lot of people in the Republican Party like her. A lot of people in the Republican Party are pro-lifers. And the idea that somehow you can just sort of throw out the base of the party and find a new base just sort of lying around somewhere to vote Republicans in is nonsense. So the trick is to have these arguments, but to convert the people you disagree with to your ideas, rather than just sort of make fun of them the way Kathleen has been doing. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Were committed socialists. By the time of the Enabling Act to seize their power, they had largely jettisoned that ideology and moved toward partnership with the industrial security. So really, when they were in power, were they not really kind of moving toward a more capitalist partnership?
No. I mean, it's a legitimate question. There's a debate in the literature, but the literature is moving away from that. Is moving more towards my position. Michael Mann, an esteemed and respected scholar of fascism, who wrote a very critical review of my book for the Washington Post. In his book, called, it's easy to remember, Fascists. In his book, he argues that if the war hadn't gotten in the way, the Nazis would have moved to basically abolishing private property. You are right that there were more ardent socialists in the early Nazi movement, the Strasser brothers and whatnot. There was even a movement called National Bolshevism, which was part of the National Socialist movement, and that Hitler did get rid of these guys. But the Nazi government was moving very rapidly towards nationalization of industry across a wide spectrum. And this, you know, it's funny, you know. Nationalism and socialism, according to all this Marxist dogma, where they believed in the international communism and whatnot, nationalism and socialism were supposed to be opposites too. But in practical life, when you nationalize an industry, you socialize it. When you have socialized medicine, you have nationalized healthcare. When Hugo Chavez is talking about nationalizing the oil industry, he's talking about socializing the oil industry. And the Nazis were decidedly moving in that direction. Robert Paxton and a couple of other scholars of fascism, they make a very important point, which is that by the time you get to 37, 38, It's very difficult to distinguish the ideological underpinnings of fascist economic doctrine from the necessity for a war economy. And at that point, they became very pragmatic and just simply went with whatever worked best for them. I argue in my book that, you know, fascist economics are, you know, the technical word for it is corporatism, right? Which does not mean government by IBM, right? Corporatism includes corporations where social units like labor, like churches and all that kind of stuff, that all of them would sit around the table and they would hash out the economy amongst themselves, which is very much what you had under the New Deal, under the trade association system, under the NRA codes, where the biggest economic players would sit around the table. But the natural logic of all of this was to move in the direction towards ever-increasing nationalization and socialism. And we saw this in fascist Italy as well. When Mussolini ends up as a puppet in the Salo Republic, all he does is re-embrace socialism, warp and woof. And so I would argue, even if you have a problem, even if you have the problem that you have, talking about in the later 1930s, the kind of economic system that they even backed into as a pragmatic matter has less to do with free market economics of the right and more to do with the sort of statist economics of the left. I would argue that the Democratic Party is vastly more corporatist than the Republican Party, even though the Republican Party is too corporatist too. But if you look at the idea factories of who, you know, the think tanks on the left and the think tanks on the right, all the think tanks on the left embrace corporatism. They want to bail out the auto industry. They want public-private partnerships. They want to use big corporations as government by proxy to provide health care and whatnot. You look at things like the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a good law, an honorable law. I'm not saying it's evil. It's wholeheartedly embraced by big corporations because it serves as a barrier to entry to smaller firms. If your 500th employee requires you to become all of a sudden totally ADA compliant, then your 500th employee costs you tens of millions of dollars. And so small firms didn't like this stuff because it's a regulatory barrier to entry. Big firms like Coca-Cola, they can pass on the cost of this for less than a half of a penny per Coke can, right? And it is the left that wants to do this kind of stuff more than the right. The right wants corporations that fail to fail, right? We want creative destruction. We brag, you know, the libertarian free market side, we brag about how the Fortune 500 list has all these new companies on it and all the old companies went the way of the dodo bird. The left wants to keep all these things going, and their economics is much more of a 1950s cartelized system. And I think that if you look at the logic of both fascist Italy and Nazi Germany, it was moving from this corporatist thing much more towards a blanket socialist one. Yes, sir. I have lots of dear friends who would consider Lincoln a fascist. I am not one of them. For several reasons. One is, you know, if militarism, right, as the commonly understood, not the stuff, social benefits of war, moral equivalent of war stuff I'm talking about, if just old-fashioned Prussian heel-clicking militarism, right, is the definition of fascism, then we've had fascist regimes going back to, what, the Spartans, the Etruscans, you know, militarism is a fairly constant theme of most of human history in terms of organizing society, military castes and whatnot. You know, I mean, Plato's Republic, was that fascist? Maybe. But you get to this point where one of the things that you need to do is talk about social organization, social mobilization. The progressives loved militarism because they saw it as the best means of mobilizing and organizing civil society, of organizing non-war society. That's the whole point of the moral equivalent of war thing. I've seen no evidence, and I'm open to argument about this, that Abraham Lincoln had any desire to keep all of the United States in a permanent war footing after the war. He did not see war as the central organizing principle of how we should organize peacetime society. And the other ingredient that's missing is modern technology. You can't really have the sort of Orwellian groupthink, propaganda ministry type stuff if you don't have the technology of a modern society. And so even if Lincoln had those aspirations, which I don't think he had, it's not until you basically get the Committee for Public Information and these things under Wilson where you start having the actual technology where you can penetrate into all the nooks and crannies of society. But it is telling, you know, Woodrow Wilson loved Lincoln, even though he thought freeing the slaves was the worst thing that ever happened in the United States and was a committed racist. He resegregates, you know, the federal government. He is the guy who comes up with the system of requiring photos on government applications so that you can tell if someone's black, that way not get them a job. The Dixiecrats wanted them to reimpose Jim Crow throughout the entire society. He couldn't do it, and they were very disappointed with that, but he gave them some fringe benefits like screening Birth of the Nation in the West Wing. And basically, anyway, we can get into all the Klan stuff. Anyway, but he loved Lincoln. And he loved Lincoln for all the wrong reasons. Hated Lincoln's ends, loved Lincoln's means. Loved the suspension of habeas corpus. Loved the unifying and centralization of the government. Loved all of that stuff for the same reasons that Wilson loved Bismarck. But the freeing of the slaves thing was really unfortunate. And when you think about it, that is an incredibly disgusting way of thinking about Lincoln, that you loved all of the stuff that's lamentable for the noble cause that he was committed to, you know, and thought the noble cause was, in fact, lamentable. But I don't think we want to fall into the trap of just simply saying that any authoritarian regime is fascist, because especially in academic literature, there's a profound distinction between an authoritarian regime and a totalitarian regime. And I don't think that Lincoln was a totalitarian. Yes, sir. No, you first, and I'll get you.
Why do you think in modern literature, modern political thought, there is a necessity to associate fringe movements with certain ends of the political spectrum, whether they're the right or the left? And moreover, do you think, what benefit does that bring to society in order to political development?
Well, I'm not sure I understand. Which fringe movements do you have in mind? Well, I mean, in the case of fascism, and this is something I had to leave out for the purposes of time, it's a very straightforward thing. In 1928, Stalin realizes that these fascist movements are eating his lunch. It turns out that people wanted to be socialists, but they also wanted to be Germans or Italians. They wanted that sense of belonging to a culture, to a nation, and all that kind of stuff. The literature is full of these wonderful, fascinating interviews, book by a guy, Theodor Abel, social scientists in the 1930s who interviewed all of these original joiners of the Nazi Party, asking them why they joined. And overwhelming numbers of them would say, I really loved the socialism of the Reds. But this idea of kowtowing to Moscow, of listening to the Russians, why should we do that? We're Germans. We're proud Germans. And the wonderful thing about the Nazis is that they could be nationalists and socialists. The Nazi Party flag, that big red flag, right? The red in the flag is to attract communists. The white in the flag and the swastika are to attract nationalists. And that's the two things together. And Stalin realized that this was a winning formula, because it turned out that a lot of people didn't want one world government and to kowtow to Moscow and all the rest. So in 1928, Stalin comes out with his social theory of fascism, which he dictates that any progressive organization, left-wing organization, that is not loyal to Moscow is ipso facto fascist, can no longer be called socialist. And so in the United States, all of these useful idiots, as Lenin liked to call them, bought into this hook, line, and sinker and basically said that anybody who was anti-Soviet, anti-Stalin, was a fascist. When Trotsky is murdered in Mexico at the orders of Stalin, has an ice axe shoved in his head, Stalin explains that the reason he did it was because Trotsky was leading a fascist coup. And this practice of basically saying anyone who's disloyal to the party line is by definition a fascist, this use of the word fascist to mean heretic, disloyal to the cause, has stuck with us ever since. But it's important to keep in mind that this left-right thing is not an American or British thing. It does not come from the Anglo-American tradition. It comes from the seating chart in the friggin' French National Assembly, right, where the loyalists to the regime sat on the right, and the more radical you got, the more to the left you moved. In the British tradition, in Parliament, you line up the yeas and nays. It's a completely different thing. And up until the 1930s, this idea of right and left as important conceptual frameworks in the Anglo-American political tradition was still considered kind of alien. I think there was one sentence in like five pages in the Encyclopedia Britannica, no, the Oxford English Dictionary. There's like five pages in the word right. There's like one sentence that says, in continental Europe, supporters of the regime or whatever. I mean, it just was not considered an Anglo-American term for understanding these things. But again, the useful idiots have imported huge amounts of this kind of thing, and we've imbibed this way of looking at these things. But the use of fascist as a right-wing thing comes directly from a brilliant PR campaign by the Stalinists. Yes, okay, the second to last one. Well, first of all, thank you. You know, and being from National Review and all the rest, let me just sort of stipulate that Edin Burke was put on this planet to chew gum and kick ass, and he ran out of gum a long time ago. That said, I don't think it's necessarily Christianity per se. Zbigniew Brzezinski, who I'm not a huge fan of in any other sphere, did wonderful work on totalitarianism. He's one of the leading scholars of totalitarianism. And one of the things he points out is that in totalitarianism, the real crime is to be an island of separateness, to not align yourself completely with the state or the movement or the cause, you know, to be apart from. And the problem with Christianity, particularly historically the problem with Catholicism for people of this sort of totalitarian bent, and the Kulturkampf in Germany is a fascinating thing to study in this regard, is that you seem to have dual loyalties. You know, you were loyal to Rome, or you were loyal to your faith, and you're not loyal to your nation, you know. And this drove people like Bismarck batty. And obviously, the Nazis had big problems with Christianity. They had an even bigger problem with Judaism. And... but for similar reasons, more acute, obviously, with Judaism, alas, and it has to do with this idea of being apart from, not with the program. You know, the most fascistic thing you'll hear on any college campus, and you hear it every day on every college campus, is if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. You know, screw you. You know. I thought the whole point was that I didn't have to join up with one big thing. The whole idea that there's no safe harbor, you know, there's no place where you can just do your own thing or have your own causes. You must be part of the solution as dictated by the movement, or you're a problem. And that is the animating ethos of all totalitarianisms, is that, you know, and in fascist, in Nazi Germany and fascist Italy, they didn't do what the communists did, which was just nationalize everything. You know, state school this, state bowling league that, you know, that kind of thing. What instead they said is that any institution that does not play ball with the state, with the Nazi party, any institution where the leaders don't join the Nazi party, that institution is going to have problems. And the problem with Christianity is that it creates a dual loyalty. You know, that whole point of that Hitler Youth song is this whole idea that everyone has to be married to Hitler and Hitler's cause and the Führerprinzip, and you can't have any other loyalties. And that is what drives totalitarians crazy, is this the idea that someone, that not all oars are pulling in the same direction. The Nazis had a word for it called Gleichschaltung, which means coordination. It's borrowed from electrical engineering, where every chip, every instrument, every mechanism of society all had to be pushing in the same direction. And when you listen to environmentalists today, when you listen to totalitarians from any era, anywhere, that desire for a Gleichschaltung, where we're all in it together, we're all working hardest to make this the best yearbook ever, that is the overriding spirit of totalitarianism. It is not singling out some political enemies and killing them. That may be evil and authoritarian. It's not totalitarian. And you know, people like Jean Kirkpatrick in the 1970s would make these very serious distinctions between authoritarians and totalitarians. Pinochet may have been an evil dictator, right? But he let lots of civil society flourish and grow. Totalitarians don't believe in civil society. Everyone is part of one society, one great leap forward that we're all going to do together, holding hands, marching to the sunny uplands of history together. That is the totalitarian mindset. And obviously things like Christianity and Judaism, but also, you know, it's an idiotic movie, but that Swing Kids movie, you know, where the kids are listening to jazz, that was, you know, jazz was against, you know, why aren't you listening to Wagner, damn it? You know, everyone's got to be on the same page in a totalitarian society. And Christianity is one of the obvious islands of separateness that inflames the minds of totalitarians. Okay, last question. Yes? Mm-hmm. Yes. The last part, I'm sorry. Oh, the difference between the right and left and all of it? Yeah. There's less of a difference between John McCain and Barack Obama, alas. On this stuff than I would like. My problem with the way John McCain talks about it is that it's not very philosophically sophisticated. He basically says we have to dedicate ourselves to a cause larger than ourselves, and he immediately then leaps to the idea of national service, national allegiance to the national government in Washington or whatnot and all that kind of thing, or working for the government or being involved in government in some way, right? Or paid volunteerism in a government program, which I always thought was sort of an oxymoron. And the problem with this is that I don't know anybody, except maybe some college kids, who aren't dedicated to causes larger than themselves, right? Or infants, right? I'm dedicated, you know, if I weren't dedicated to any causes larger than myself, and first of all, these would have to be very large causes, I would be a radical anarchist, right? I wouldn't give a rat's ass about my family, about my community, about my business. I would simply be grasping, devil take the hindmost, everywhere I was, right? The reality is most people are dedicated to all sorts of causes larger than themselves, these Burkean little platoons. You know, their churches, their communities, their block, their teams, their families, their friends. These are all causes larger than ourselves. And this idea that automatically translates any cause larger than ourselves into government service of some kind is deeply offensive to the de Tocquevillian vision of America, of a civil society. In terms of Barack Obama, I dislike it even more. Because when I listen to John McCain, what I hear him saying is he wants to reform government at the end of the day. You know, I mean, he gives all this lip service stuff to the volunteerism stuff, but he wants to reform government. When I listen to Barack Obama, I hear him saying he wants to reform America. You know, I listen to his wife say that he wants to fix our broken souls. Her exact word. I thought we had a Second Amendment to keep the government from trying to fix our souls. And when I hear him talk about unity, again, I don't think Barack Obama in any way, shape, or form, let me be very clear about this, I don't think he's an evil man. I think he's a good man. I think he's a decent man. He's clearly a loving father and husband. I think he has the best of intentions and all this kind of stuff. I just think he's very, very wrong. And when I hear him talk about unity, right, how we need to have unity and hope and hopeful unity and unified hopefulness from where unified hopefulification of unified unification, whatever the hell he's talking about, right? I listen to this stuff and it makes me very, very nervous. Unity is not a political virtue in and of itself. Unity is not a good in and of itself. You know who's unified? Rape gangs. Right? The mafia. They're unified. Also, wonderful people are unified. You know, Shriners or the Catholic Church. I mean, lots of organizations are unified, but it depends what you're doing, right? And if you read the Federalist Papers, which I know is very much out of fashion these days, read Federalist 10, Federalist 51. When you read these things, you sort of discover that the Founding Fathers were very disturbed by notions of unity, by the dangers posed by unity, right? We have divided government, legislative, executive, judicial, each one vying against each other, checking each other. We have separation of powers. We have now 50 state governments, each one of these divided up into various branches of government. We have a Bill of Rights, which guarantees the rights of minority against the dangers of majority persecution. In our political culture, the hero is not the mob. The hero is the lone individual who stands up against the mob and says, you're not going to hang this man today. And fascism, right, its symbol was the fasces, a bundle of sticks around an axe. That meant, since the Etruscans first came up with it, strength in numbers, strength in unity. For fascism, unity was a political virtue in and of itself. For the Founding Fathers in the Anglo-American tradition, unity was something to be very nervous about. Factions were something to be very nervous about. And it's an amazing thing. When I listen to liberals talk about, first hint that you're talking to a liberal is when they say, I don't believe in labels. Right? I've never heard a conservative ever say they don't believe in labels. I believe in labels. Labels are another word for words. I believe in words, just words, how dare you call that chair a chair? But it's part of this trick, which goes back to the pragmatism of progressives and liberalism generally, that they think they're non-ideological. And so when you hear people say, oh, we need to move beyond our partisan differences, we need to move beyond our ideological divide and our philosophical disagreements, and for the sake of unity, join hands, sing kumbaya, and get to do the hard work the American people need done, right? You hear this all the time. I've been following politics for 20 years. Gesundheit. I've been following politics for 20 years. I have never heard anyone say, we need to move beyond our partisan disagreements. We need to move beyond our philosophical divides. We need to, unite for the sake of unity. So therefore, in the name of bipartisanship, I'm going to abandon all of my principles and agree with you. Right? People only say this when they want you to shut up and get with their program. Right? And if you listen to Barack Obama talk about bipartisanship, when you listen to him talk about unity, when you listen to him talk about how this is the moment when we're going to do all of these things, when you hear him invoke Abraham Lincoln as his model, whose unity came with, which was necessary in my lights, I think I'm still allowed to say that in Virginia, what he did was necessary, but it lamentably resulted in the deaths of 600,000 people and was the unity enforced at the tip of a gun. And when he talks about that unity being something he wants to emulate, that makes me hope he's just not thinking this through. And that's what disturbs me about Barack Obama, is the way he talks about these things as these, that anyone who disagrees is bitter, clinging to their boomsticks and sky god, and if only they would drop their Marxist false consciousness and join with the program, and then everything would be solved. That's what I hear when I hear him talk, and I hope he proves me wrong. Anyway, thank you all very, very much. Sure. Thank you.